We're going to continue our study that we started last week, our summer session on the issue of ambassadorship. And we didn't get through the first session on the DVD, which isn't the end of the world. I know that there were some folks that weren't able to be here last week for various reasons. I want to start with some review and then kind of want to go from there into some other discussion and then watch the end of what he says here in session one. But I want to start with some review. So if you would, 2 Corinthians 5, and also again Colossians chapter 1. So we just started getting into where he was talking about the first tactic or strategy, which is the Columbo tactic, when we kind of ran out of time and had to stop it. So I do want to review some stuff and kind of make sure that we're understanding kind of what he's saying and where he's going with this. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 20 to start with. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 20. He says, now that we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God did beseech you by us, we pray you in Christ's stead, be reconciled to God. So that's a verse that we started with way back in January. Now I'm listing these studies under a different, I'm listing them as a new series, even though they're very much related to what we've done in the past. But I've titled it on YouTube and the church's website as Tactics 21st Century Ambassadorship is what I called it. Okay, and then go to Colossians chapter 1 as well. We looked at this verse last time. So one of the first things that Kuchel talks about, both in the book and in the DVD, was the nature of a 21st century ambassador. Okay, and he talked about how ambassadors need to have essentially three different skills, okay? And he mentions them as follows. He talks about knowledge. So in other words, you have to know the material. You have to know what the information is. So he defined this as an accurately informed mind, okay? An accurately informed mind. So this is the believer knowing the scripture, knowing the doctrine, knowing what's going on as far as ambassadorship. Then he says the second skill of a 21st century ambassador is wisdom, which he defined as an artful method or a way of going about it, okay, and doing it in a winsome, artful way. And then he also talked about character. And under character, he talked about an attractive manner. In other words, going about it in a way that's, you know, not going to be off-putting and this kind of a thing. Okay, so he's identifying that. He didn't go to this verse, but we did last Sunday, Colossians chapter 1, verse 9. For this cause also, since the day we heard it, did not cease to pray for you and to desire that you might be filled with the knowledge of His will. So there's the knowledge, the desire to be filled with the knowledge of His will. So that's Paul's prayer for the Colossians, right? Then he says, filled with the knowledge of His will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding. So that's there's the wisdom aspect of it, right? You have knowledge, you know the information, but then you have that knowledge, but you're able to be wise regarding it, okay? You have wisdom and spiritual understanding. And then he says in verse 10, that ye might walk worthy of the Lord unto all pleasing, being fruitful in every work and increasing in the knowledge of God. And there's the character aspect of that, right? The attractive manner, the walk that's well-pleasing, and so on and so forth. So all of those fundamental components are there, okay? Then he talks about we looked last time at the difference, as he says, between gardening and harvesting, right? And he says that, he talks about how instead of thinking that you have to, like, close the deal and get to the gospel in every conversation, that if you go into a conversation with the more attainable goal of just simply putting a stone in someone's shoe, that's the goal to have. And this is the idea of being a gardener and putting the stone in somebody's shoe, giving them something to think about, something to ponder on, something that they can't ignore, that they're going to have to think about more deeply or longer, or whatever term you want to use for it, that might prompt them to come back and ask more conversation, or will at least prime them for when they encounter another believer that is now going to say something different, right? And so we looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and what Paul says there about planting and watering and the Lord giving the increase, and talks about how the planter, I'm messing it up, I think. Why don't you just go to 1 Corinthians 3. I got a lot of different verses running in my mind, not only for this study, but more specifically for what we're going to do later on in the main service. But 1 Corinthians 3, verse 5, who then is Paul and who is Apollos, but ministers by whom ye believed, even as the Lord gave to every man? I have planted in Apollos water, but God gave the increase. So we looked at the idea of planting and watering as being involved in that gardening process. God's going to be the one that is ultimately going to give the increase. Statistics vary, but I tried to look it up this week, and my sources, the different sources that I looked at varied somewhat. But they say that it takes about 6 encounters with the gospel before somebody believes it. Okay, before somebody trusts it. Now, that's the average. Obviously, you could think of people who hear it, believe it right away. Okay? You can think of other people that maybe got to have more time invested in before they believe or trust in the finished work of Christ. But the statistics indicate that somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 encounters before somebody is going to choose to believe. Now, I don't know if that's true. I'm just sharing with you what I read. My experience is that rarely does somebody trust the crosswork of Christ the first time you talk to them. Okay? It typically does take more than one conversation before somebody is going to be willing to trust the gospel. But that's not, you know, a few weeks back Tom was going through that sales process and how he's comparing that to evangelism and so forth. And you know, that's where you have to follow up with somebody, and you have to, you know, you have to make the connection, you have to follow up, you have to kind of do the necessary steps to try to maintain, you know, make sure that stone, they don't forget about it, right? And that's where, you know, some good thinking on the part of a ambassador is going to be important. Now, I rewatched this week, and he mentioned something that we kind of touched on, but I thought about it in a little bit different way. We talked last Sunday about the difference between strategy and tactics. Remember that? Okay? Our strategy is 1 Timothy 2. Go back to 1 Timothy 2. If it kicked me out of the spot, that would have been a problem. Okay, so our strategy is 1 Timothy 2, verse 4. Okay? Who will have all men be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth? What's the will of God? The will of God is that all men be what?
Saved.
Okay? And secondly, is that they would come to what?
Knowledge of the truth,
right? And so we talked about this, right? We know what our objective is. We know what our strategy is going to be. Our strategy is going to be, number one, to get all men saved. Number two, to have people who are already saved do what? Come to the knowledge of the truth, right? And under this, we talked about a lot of different things, right? We talked about what would be included in that strategy of trying to get people to be saved. We talked about the clarity of the gospel. We talked about the Bible, clarity on the Bible, what the Word of God is. Clarity even on the English translation issue of where God's Word is in English. We talked about clarity about dispensational things. Paul's our apostle, the mystery. All of that would fit under these strategic goals of having all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. The grace life. Understanding total forgiveness. Understanding identity-based living. Who you are in Christ. All of that would fit under the category of the knowledge of the truth. So here we have these two different categories, two different things that we're trying to accomplish. The tactics then come into play as to how we're going to what? how we're going to try to accomplish that strategy, right? How we're going to do that. Now, if you think about strategies, so strategy is like the big picture, right? So you think, for example, just to grab a random example of the D-Day invasion, okay? The strategy there is to establish a beachhead in Europe to eventually defeat who? Hitler, right? That's what they're trying to accomplish, right? They're trying to accomplish securing an area where they can land their army and begin the process of freeing Europe from Nazi occupation, right? Okay. But in order to do that, do they have a lot of different tactics that they're seeking to utilize in order to accomplish that, right? So you think about, I'm just going to use three things. It was far more complex than this, but I'm just going to use three things, right? Before, you have the naval shelling of the German positions on the shore, right? You have the dropping of the airborne divisions behind German lines in northern France, right? You have the actual landing of the men on the beaches in those five areas in northern France, right? So all three of those things, I'm just keeping it simple, those are all tactical moves. Okay? Those are all individual moves that are trying to accomplish the greater what? The greater strategy, right? So this isn't like they just decided, well, what day do we want to do this? Oh, let's do it on June 6th and it'll be great. No, this is all what? This is all planned, this is all time, this is all coordinated, and with the hopefully that all these things, all these different tactical pieces are going to come together to accomplish the strategic objective of establishing a foothold in Europe from which they could then begin the process of, you know, driving Hitler and removing him, okay? So you have the strategy, that's the big picture, that's the overall thing, the tactics are going to be the individual moves and maneuvers are going to be used to accomplish that, right? Okay? So what he's getting at, what Kukul is getting at in this series, in this book, and in this series of videos, is a way to do that. Now he said something else that I think, that I personally find interesting, okay? He says that what tactics will allow you to do is move from content to conversation. I was thinking about that, and I feel like we do a real good job here. Content, right? You come to church, you have this hour, you have the main hour where we're basically always giving what? Content, right? We're teaching doctrine, we're giving content, we're trying to explain things, right? We're trying to increase your what? Your knowledge over here, right? So what the tactics are really about is taking this content and doing what? Moving that over into what? Over into conversation, right? Moving that just off the theoretical, you know, plane of your mind into actually engaging people with that information, with that truth that you're learning, right? With this knowledge that you're accumulating. At the beginning of Grace School of the Bible, Brother Jordan has a little illustration that I think is appropriate. He talks about if you let this circle here, this is the Sea of Galilee. Okay, this is the Jordan River, and what's at the bottom here? This is the dead what? The Dead Sea, right? Okay, so why do they call this the Dead Sea? Nothing can survive in this, right? Because the salt content and stuff is so high that no marine life will exist. Well, there's a reason for that, right? The Sea of Galilee has water comes into the Sea of Galilee from the north, right? And then the Sea of Galilee has an inlet, but then it also has what? An outlet, right? And so the outlet is obviously the Jordan River. The difference is with the Dead Sea is all the stuff that comes down here from the Jordan River, once it gets down here, it's got what? It's got no outlet. It's got nowhere to go. Okay? So again, this is just an illustration, right? So, as far as thinking about ourselves as ambassadors, I think we should endeavor to be more like the Sea of Galilee, where we're taking information in, we're taking in content, but then we're taking the content that we're taking in and we're moving it to what? conversation, right? Whereas if you just seek to accumulate all this stuff, all this head knowledge, all this content, and you never really use it for anything or do anything with it, never go out and engage as an ambassador, this is kind of the idea that he's getting at. And so what he's trying to establish for us is some tactical ways to take the content and move it to conversation. Okay? So does anybody have any thoughts, questions, or comments about that before we move on?
We used to call that sit, soak, and sour when you get in the Dead Sea. You sit, you soak in a lot of information. If you don't give it out, then you start to sour.
That's a good.
Go stale.
Sit, soak, or sour. Okay, I never heard that one before. That's good. Okay. And he's got in here in the workbook that goes with the video, he's got in here a few highlights as far as ambassador skills, and one of them I want to share at this point was this one. He says, when discussing controversial issues, be careful not to resort to slick rhetoric, empty slogans, loaded words, ridicule, or name-calling that is misleading, but instead use reasonable arguments. And the other thing that he mentions here is that it's important as an ambassador to give mental attention to what is going on when you're seeking to engage people in conversation. And he talks about the difference here between, the illustration that he uses for this is the difference between playing chess and playing one-on-one basketball. How many of you play chess? Okay, you play chess. Chess is a one-on-one game, right? Basketball can be a one-on-one game too, right? But in chess, what you're doing is you're just simply matching basically minds. It's basically your mind and understanding of the game versus their mind and understanding of what? The game. One-on-one basketball, by contrast, is much more fluid. There's more movement to it, okay? That people are moving around. People in conversation will oftentimes move the target, right? Or they'll say, as people say, they'll move the goalposts. You'll think they're talking about one thing, but then all of a sudden you find they want to bring up this other thing over here, right? And so it's a lot more of a fluid thing. So he says that this approach resembles one-on-one basketball more than chess, involving constant motion, adjustment, and adaptation. The tactical approach requires as much careful listening as it does thoughtful response. Now, if you're anything like me, how many of you get into a conversation and the first thing you're doing is thinking about what you're going to say to the person? You're not really listening to what the person is saying. You're just sort of, okay, you're formulating your response. You're not really listening to what they're saying. Okay? So he's recommending that we take more of an approach of try to listen to understand before responding. So all this is kind of review along with a little bit of a different thing. A different perspective thinking about the idea of moving from content to conversation. So what I want to do is I want to play the next segment of the video. We watch maybe 2 minutes of this. There's going to be about 2 minutes of overlap from last week. He's going to begin to explain the Columbo tactic, okay? And then a couple times, maybe at least once, I want to stop it and make sure that we capture a few ideas on the board so that we can talk about them a little bit further, okay? So he's just starting. I'm going to set this recorder here, so hopefully we get a better volume on the video.
If you ever get something that's Salvation Army, my wife taught me, you always check the pockets because you never know what you're going to... Wait a minute. Oh, my gosh. Look at that. A cigar. See, Lieutenant Columbo, he always has a cigar. Look at it. This is just a plastic one, so don't worry. All right? No problems here. I actually hate cigars. Whenever I find one, I always destroy it by fire. Completely. I don't want anybody to stumble. Anyway, so Lieutenant Columbo shows up. He also's got a pad of paper, right? But he can't use his pad of paper. Why not? Because he doesn't have a pen or pencil. He's got to bum a pencil off of somebody else, right? And this guy walks around the crime scene, scratching his head, mumbling to himself. He doesn't look like he can think his way out of a wet paper bag. He's stupid, but he's stupid like a fox. Because at some point, he's going to pause. He's got a method to his madness. He'll pause and rub his brow like he's deep in painful thought and say something like, I don't know. Yeah, something about this thing that bothers me. Do you mind if I ask you a question? And he asks the question, right? And then he gets the answer. You're very intelligent. And one more thing. And then he one more things them to death, right? With question after question after question. Pretty soon people start getting upset. He says, I'm sorry. It's because I ask all these questions, but I can't help it. It's a habit. And this is a habit that you want to get into. The key to the Columbo tactic is that the Christian goes on the offensive in an inoffensive way with carefully selected questions to advance the conversation. Let me say that again because it's so important. The key to the Columbo tactic is that you go on the offensive, but you do it in an inoffensive way with carefully selected questions that can advance the conversation. Now, why questions? Well, for one, questions are polite. You ask questions of people, you draw them out.
Okay, what's the first reason to ask questions? Polite, okay? Why, so, is that more polite than just going directly after them? Yeah. All right? If you go after them directly, you're probably going to raise up their defenses.
Okay. Interested is interesting, basically. So you're being courteous to people when you ask questions of them. Another thing is questions can buy you time. If you're not sure...
So what's another reason why to ask... What's another advantage of asking questions? They buy you time. Now, when he says that, what does he mean? When he says that questions buy you time, what do you think he means?
Gives you a chance to really respond to what the real problem is and time to think about what actually is going on.
A lot of times, this stuff happens real fast. And you can kind of buy yourself some time by asking a couple questions. The questions may not be, you might even already know the answers, but sometimes you might want to ask a question just to allow yourself some ability to think through what do you want to say or how are you going to respond. So number one, they're polite. Number two, they buy time.
How to proceed, and you're not sure where to go. Well, you ask these questions, you could be thinking about it. Another thing is questions get you valuable information. So
what's the third advantage to asking questions?
Information.
You can gain information. Okay, well, in a minute he's going to go over the first Columbo question, which is what do you mean by that? And if you just ask that question, you're going to be gaining information about what the person means, what they think, why they think it. So there are some real advantages of asking questions here that he's covering.
Which direction to go. But the biggest value of using questions is it puts you in the driver's seat.
Okay, so fourthly, he identifies that the biggest advantage is it puts you where? Now, why would it do that? How would asking a question put you in the driver's seat of a conversation? If we're talking about moving from content to conversation, if we're talking about the use of questions to go on the offensive in an inoffensive way, how would the use of questions put you in the driver's seat, Bill?
Maybe the wrong word. It's put them on the offensive, or on the defensive, to defend what they believe by answering that question, and you get more information.
Okay.
You're steering the direction of the conversation.
Yeah, you're steering it, right? So, in other words, the person has said something, and you're functioning here within a tactical range where you're trying to not be offensive. You might be asking questions for some personal reasons to gain information or buy yourself time. But ultimately, if you're doing this, are you sort of the one that's in control of what's happening in this conversation, right? One of the biggest reasons I feel that people don't engage in conversation is because they don't feel like they have any skills any skills or tactical strategies for what if they get mad at me, then what am I going to do? What if they ask me a question that I can't answer, then what am I going to do? Okay? Hey, if you get asked a question that you can't answer, you just say, I don't know. If you could give me some time, I'll certainly look into it and get back to you. Would that be okay with you? Okay? Most people are okay with that. The worst thing to do is to try to make something up. Okay? To try to feel like you have to say something, so you have to make something up. Or you don't understand what the person's saying, so you infer what they're saying, right? And then you begin sort of attacking what your perceived understanding is of what they're saying, or responding to that when you're missing the point, or that's really not what they're saying at all, right? So there's an ambassador skill box, and he says here, misrepresenting of you, even by accident, is a serious misstep. When we distort someone's view, especially when we make it appear weaker than it is, we are committing what is called the straw man fallacy. Setting up lifeless imitation of a friend's view, or otherwise known as a straw man, to easily knock down instead of dealing with his or her actual view. If you're guilty of setting up a straw man, and you may find you're given a brilliant refutation of a view that the other person does not actually believe in or hold. Okay? So, four advantages here to giving questions. The main use of the questions is to go on the offensive in an inoffensive way. Okay?
You're in the driver's seat. The focus is not on you. It's on the other person. You're the one who's in the driver's seat. You're managing the conversation. Okay? So here's a simple guideline for you. If you hit a roadblock, ask a question. If you get into a difficult situation, ask a question. If you're not sure where to go next, ask a question. Now, Columbo is going to be your game plan. Remember I promised you I was going to give you a game plan? That's Columbo. Okay? It's going to give you the ability to maneuver in conversations. Now there are three different uses of Columbo, and over our course we're going to talk about each one of those things. There are three parts, in other words, of the game plan. Here's the first part of the game plan, the first application of Columbo. The first part of our game plan is to gather information. Remember when Columbo comes on the crime scene, he's got to gather information to be able to solve the crime, right? And that's the same thing that you're going to do. I want to emphasize this because I don't want you to get ahead of yourself. This is easy to do. We have a game plan that we're going to talk about. This is the first step. And what I mean by that is when you get in a circumstance where you'd like to have an impact for Christ, the first thing you think about doing is not getting to the gospel, not answering questions, not dealing with challenges, just gathering information. Okay? You want to know the lay of the land before you can go further. Now, a question can be a casual conversation starter. It can buy you some valuable time. But most of the time, you just need more information to know how to proceed further. I had a fellow that was sitting next to me in an airplane. And we got in a conversation. I was using the game plan, and it became obvious through our conversation that I was a Christian. He said he wasn't. Well, that's good to know. He said he used to be a Christian, but he's not anymore. You think that's important to know? I'd say so. In fact, he used to be a preacher's kid. I said, John, how do you used to be a preacher's kid? Did your dad die or something? He said, no, my dad didn't die. He's just no longer a preacher. In fact, he's no longer a Christian. You think that's good information? You think there's any baggage sitting here next to me? Can you imagine if I had just started out with the simple gospel with this guy, how he would have responded? Been there, done that, and it hurt. Okay? But
so, is what he's saying there, like, making sense to you? Okay? So, Naylene, I don't want to put you on the spot, but what about that is making sense to you, if you would mind sharing?
Well, the information that you're gathering just by asking a question is his tactic number one. You know, you learn what their situation is and how they feel about Christianity or whatever it is you're seeking.
So then can you make a situational adjustment? You're not adjusting the truth. You're not adjusting the content. You're not changing the gospel. You're not changing what this is. But you're able then to navigate or make a situational adjustment in the what? In the conversation, to hopefully have that come out to the better is what he's getting at. Okay, Bill, you look like you had a comment possibly. Am I misreading you?
No, I'm just thinking how difficult it is sometimes when you already talk about it, to listen. Letting your mind already go on something else that was already spoken or said in that four steps out there. Just an observation.
So again, the point of this is not to just, I guess we're giving content, right? I mean, we're giving you a content in the sense of a way to think about having what? Conversation. But the goal of what he's presenting here and the goal of that book is not to just give you more content. It's to help you take it and lead to this, right? As you take your 21st century ambassador skills here that he has identified, understanding the difference between gardening and harvesting with the goal of putting a stone in the shoe. So now he's asked some questions and he's ascertained with the guy on the airplane that, you know, he's really told him a lot, right? He's told him about the family dynamics. He's told him about their past, you know, history as far as what they believed and how they functioned and so forth. He's really told him quite a bit at this point.
Have I asked him these questions that drew him out? I'm gathering information so that a kind of I can see a topography, spiritually speaking, and where he's at. And I realize that there are minefields there. And now I know how to respond so I can avoid those minefields. So our first step in the game plan is to gather information. And here's the model question that I'm going to give you. That model question is, what do you mean by that? This question, what do you mean by that, can be used in lots of different ways. It's the question I asked the witch in Wisconsin. I looked at her jewelry. I said, does that jewelry have spiritual significance? What do you mean by that is basically the question. Somebody says to you, there is no God. Well, you could start giving all kinds of arguments for the existence of God, but maybe it'd be better to say, what do you mean by that? That is, what kind of God don't you believe in? Maybe you don't believe in a God that's up on a throne somewhere with a long beard in outer space. I mean, I don't believe in that kind of God either. Maybe they don't believe in a God of organized religion, but they believe in some kind of force. Maybe they believe in nothing but the natural realm. You can't go further effectively if you don't know what that is, okay? Once a student said, everything's relative. How do you respond to that? Well, I would never go after the issue itself without asking some questions first, like, what do you mean by relative? I know what it means, but I don't know that he knows what it means. And what do you mean by everything? I mean, if everything means everything, isn't the statement everything is relative part of everything? Which would make that statement what? Also relative. You see the problem there. Once I had a call on my radio show and somebody said, what's a good book on Buddhism? I said, why do you want a good book on Buddhism? See, that's what do you mean by that question? And he said, well, I have a friend that I work with who's a Buddhist and I want to know how to share Christ with him. I said, well, don't get the book. That's going to cost you money. You got to read it. It's probably not his Buddhism anyway. I suggest that you go and you grab your friend and you take him to the local watering hole and buy him a latte or something like that and ask him. I'm a Christian. I understand you're a Buddhist. I don't know anything about Buddhism. Can you tell me? And you're going to get an education on Buddhism from that individual. Notice that is also a, what do you mean by that? Tell me your Buddhism. So there are lots of ways to use this question. Just one thing to keep in mind, though. Sometimes when you ask, what do you mean by that, you're going to get what I call the sounds of silence response, which means they're not going to know what to say. Now, you think that they would know what they're thinking about and what their beliefs are actually entail, but it's not always the case.
That, in my experience, what he just said is absolutely true. People have they have all these things that they believe, but they've never explicitly given any mental thought to why do they believe these things and how do they know they're true, right? They're making these great truth claims and you say, well, what do you mean by that or how do you know that or what would you use to verify that? And they will look at you and they have absolutely no what?
No idea.
They have no idea, okay? Because most of the time, they're probably just repeating something that they've heard either on the news or something a family member said or, you know, some other thing. They're not really studying the issues themselves. They're not really looking into arguments like for whether or not God exists or whether or not Christ rose from the dead, those kinds of things. Some of the major objections of Christianity. They're just repeating things, okay? Have any of you ever had that happen to you where you're in a conversation with somebody, they're making some kind of a grand statement and you ask them,
what do you mean? And they can't even tell you what they mean. And it's clear to you that they're just repeating something that they've heard. Okay? Now, unfortunately, believers do this too. Well, I mean, we're not criticizing that. We're trying to work through a game plan to help you with that, right? That's what this is about. But a lot of times believers will just repeat stuff. And they have a lot of like platitudes that they say and can recite, but if asked what does that mean or how do you know that or, you know, something along those lines, they can't tell you really boo about why they think any of those things. Now that's not true all the time, but it certainly is the case in some instances. Okay? So let's finish the video, and then I've got some of these scenarios that I kind of want to go through and get you guys have some discussion around some of these scenarios and what are some things that could be said.
Sometimes they don't know, and you're giving them an opportunity to clarify their view, and they won't be able to advance their view based on ambiguity now because you're drawing them out with this question. It's a question you can ask all day long until the cows come home and there's no pressure on you at all. If there's any ambiguity in the response, go ahead and ask more questions. Have them spell the issue out for you, if they can. A great example of this is the problem of evil. It comes up all the time, okay? And it catches Christians flat-footed. It's a great spot for your first question. People say, what about all the evil in the world? I say, what about it? Well, doesn't that create a problem for you? What exactly is the problem? You see how what I'm doing is I'm just parrying for a moment and forcing them to be more clear about their own objection. Now, you might be thinking, well, I can ask those two questions. I don't know where to go from there, and there is more detail there. But I'll tell you, when I get into it a little bit, there's a problem with the problem of evil as an objection against Christianity. Because at some point, I'm going to ask, what do you mean by evil? And I know what they're going to say. They're going to talk about murders and rapes and tortures and that kind of stuff. And then I say, wait a minute, you just gave me examples of evil. You didn't tell me what you meant by evil. Why would you give those things as examples of evil and not something like kindness or mercy as examples of evil? So what my questions are meant to do at this point, just the first question, is to get to the core of what they mean by evil. And somewhere down the line they're going to say, well, it's because things aren't the way they're supposed to be. Now, it might be occurring to you that if there is a way that they are supposed to be, there's got to be a supposer for that.
So, do you see how he just used the questions to get to that? Now, he could have just come right out of the gate and said, boom, here it is. But that's not going to have the same effect as working the person what? Think about the way Paul teaches in the epistles, the way God, the Holy Spirit, inspires Paul to teach, right? Paul is often asking these questions, right? And he's using these logical arguments, right? For as he moves the Corinthians from, okay, here's what's going on, here's what you should consider doing, and so forth. He doesn't just start here, he starts here and he works them what? He works them through it, right? So by the time they get down here, he's made a case, he's made a point for why they should consider behaving or changing or doing whatever it is that they're doing in the way that Paul is advising, right? Well, the same thing is true in a different sense here with what he is explaining here in the video, okay? And what he says is true. You know, how, if things aren't the way they're supposed to be, how do you know how they're supposed to be? There has to be some standard that you are judging that off of in your mind, or else the statement is what? It's meaningless. It has no value as a statement unless you're comparing it to something. Okay? So, you know, when you get this idea of, and then somebody, just because he brought up the issue of the problem of evil, what often comes up is, well, you know, what about hurricanes, earthquakes, and tsunamis, and this and that? Okay? Well, as a believer, you know from Genesis chapter 3 that because of sin, God what?
Cursed the earth.
God cursed the earth, right? And the earth is groaning and travailing and so on, right? But if you're dealing with an atheist or somebody else, they might not necessarily accept that right away as a justification for what you're saying, right? But the reverse is also true. Do humans do dumb things? Like, for example, building major cities below sea level in hurricane zones. Okay? So you think about that hurricane that hit Louisiana, right? Or, Katrina hit New Orleans, right? Okay? Well, the whole city is built with this whole system of levees and stuff that keep the water out, right? And you're building the city in a known hurricane zone, and then you're going to get mad at God when perchance the hurricane happens to come through, hit the levee and flood the city, and now all of a sudden this is God's fault, right? Never mind the fact that human beings decided to build a city there, right? So, you know, people, when they ask the question of evil, they haven't necessarily thought through a lot of these things that pertain to that question. But that's another example then of how you can use the questioning, the tactical questioning, to kind of help the person realize some of it.
Which is starting to lean towards the existence of God on this issue. I don't have time to develop this anymore, but what I want you to see is even on a tough issue like the problem of evil, you can start leading with those first information gathering questions. What do you mean by that? Or some variation. And it can really give you an advantage. It gives you more information. It gives you time to think. It gives you an opportunity to reposition yourself in the argument in some way. Look at what you can accomplish with this first step of the Columbo tactic, which is the first step of our game plan. First, it immediately engages the non-believer in an interactive way. That's great. Okay. Second, it shows a genuine interest in the other person's view. That's polite. Third, it forces that person to think more carefully about exactly what he does believe. Fourth, it gets you a free education. And finally, think of it, there's no pressure on you. You're in the driver's seat. Okay? This is something very simple to do. So here's what I want you to do. This next week, I want you to focus in your conversations with other people that you hope will have a spiritual impact. I want you to focus simply on Columbo question number one. Be a student. Be a student of other people's point of view. Okay, so what did we cover in our first session together? We talked about restoring that missing piece, right? That piece that goes from the content to the conversation. And if without that piece, conversations are going to be difficult. How do you get started? We've talked about that particular issue. Next, we talked about the tactical approach in general, the skill of maneuvering in conversations, and how important that skill is for us to be good ambassadors for Christ with knowledge, wisdom, and character. The third thing we said is I suggested that you rethink your approach to this whole project, to think of yourself as a gardener, not a harvester. And to modify the goal, therefore, in your conversations, so you're not worried about trying to get to the end of the game, get people to sign on the dotted line. That might happen in some cases, but you'll see. Don't worry about that at first. Just simply try to what? Put a stone in their shoe. Try to get them thinking. Maybe move them forward just a little bit if you can. And finally, I introduced you to the game plan that will help you accomplish that goal. I call it the Columbo tactic. That is using questions to move gracefully in any conversation. Keeps you relaxed, keeps you protected. So the first step of the game plan, you gather information, you use some form of the question, what do you mean by that? Simple. You can do this. Now in our next session together, I'll introduce you to the second step of the game plan. See you then.
All right. Did anybody have any other? Yeah, Nate.
I've read this before, and I've done a few things like this in school and stuff. And I love this approach. One thing I would caution when you do this, though, is when you ask people questions, more than likely people are very happy to accommodate your questions. They're more than excited to tell you everything they believe. But people aren't stupid. So if they sense that these questions have a purpose, they'll hit the brakes really fast.
Yeah, he gets into that, I think, in the next session.
Okay.
He talks about how to, he gives you some strategies or tactics for how to sort of deal with that situation. Okay, but you are right. I mean, They're more than willing to share, but at the same time, if they think that you have some sort of, you know, you're in the driver's seat, theoretically, right? If they think you're steering them a certain way, eventually they might raise some other kind of a objection, right? But then he's gonna teach you some more tactics for how to deal with that if that happens. Okay? But that's getting a little bit ahead of where we are now. So last time we got about how much time do we have on
15 minutes.
Okay, that's about the same as camp. Okay, 15 minutes. So last time I ended with kind of giving you a scenario. We didn't even have time to discuss it, right? But he talks in the book, and he talks in the study guide here for the videos about what he calls the 10-second window. All right? So somebody has said something. It doesn't matter. They've said something, they've made a claim, and you have a short window of time to decide, are you going to engage the person in conversation or not? And if so, how are you going to do that, right? And so what these are is really some practice with what he's calling here the first tactic, or the first Colombo question, what do you mean by that? So here's a scenario I gave you last Sunday, okay? So here's the scene. You're at a dinner party at a friend's house with one of your close friends from church. The conversation ranges naturally over a number of interesting spiritual topics. Suddenly, to your surprise and embarrassment, the host's 15-year-old son announces with some belligerence that he doesn't believe in God anymore. It's simply not rational, he says. There's no proof. No one had any idea that he'd been moving in this direction. There's a stunned silence. What will you say? So, what are some things that you could say to in that moment in time, in that 10-second window, that could possibly be used to stimulate engaging? Now, understand, this is sort of a public deal, right? There's a lot of people that are watching. The person whose son has said this is no doubt embarrassed. No doubt, you know, oh my gosh, you know, what's he doing here? Okay, so what are some possible responses that you could give in a 10-second window to engage in that? Like what?
How did you come to that decision?
Okay. How did you come to that decision? Easy. Right? Now, what is he going to have to do?
Explain.
He's going to have to explain it. Right? And then as he begins to do that, can you follow up with more questions? Okay. Nate?
I would clear the fourth one first. Obviously, in that kind of situation, there's going to be his parents and other people are going to want to jump on it and kill it right away and, you know, how dare you talk like that or whatever. So clear the floor for him and say something like, you know, that's a very interesting idea. Let's look at that further. We would all like to hear what you have to say on that and then ask a question. You know, basically cue everybody else in that let's let him talk and have his space. Don't just jump down his throat and let's hear what he has to say. Then start asking your question. Make him feel like he has the floor, you know.
Okay. Anybody else? Fred, were you going to say something? So here's another one. It's the night of your weekly Bible study group. And during a discussion, a newcomer says, "Who are we to say Christianity is better than any other religion? I think the essence of Jesus' teaching is love, the same as all religions, not telling other people how to live or to believe." The rest of the group fidgets awkwardly but says nothing. What do you say? Let me read it again. See? You're not even under the gun and you're like, ooh, what would I say? Right? During the discussion, a newcomer, so this is a new person. That's probably an important detail, right? This is a person who's maybe not come to church before, not come to the Bible study. You don't know necessarily what their background is, maybe similar to the guy on the plane, right, that we just saw. So they say, "Who are we to say Christianity is no better than any other religion? I think the essence of Jesus' teaching is love, the same as all religions. Not telling other people how to live or believe." The rest of the group fidgets awkwardly but says nothing. How do you respond? Okay.
Well, what about love? There, you know, no greater love has the Father than to give up his son. But then there are different types of love in the Bible, the scriptures. You know? What kind of love? Man's kind of love, one to another? I mean,
That's going to fail you.
So you could say, how do you define love? That would be a variation of this question, right? Okay. You could say what Ernie said. What do you mean by religion? If he, you don't know what he means, right? What's he talking about? How does this person understand what love is and what religion is and all this sort of thing, right? So just by asking those simple questions, you can accomplish these things, okay, that we're talking about here. Just got one more. You're riding the university shuttle with a friend. So this one will be good for you, Caleb. It's been your experience. You're riding the university shuttle with a friend who notices a Bible in your backpack. He says, I've read the Bible before, he says. It's got some interesting stories, but people take it too seriously. It was only written by men, after all, and men make mistakes. You try to recall the points your pastor made a few weeks ago about the Bible's inspiration, but come up empty-handed. What do you say?
Do you have other books in your library that you believe?
And the inevitable answer is going to be yes. So then what could a follow-up be?
What are they?
Okay, what are they? What?
Why do you put such a high standard against the Bible?
Good. So what makes those books more authoritative in your mind than the Bible if you admit they're both written by what? Men, right? So just by engaging in that process, you can draw out a lot of information from the person and figure out what their real objection is or what their major goal or motivation might be. Okay? What's that, Naylee? Okay, let's talk about that. What do you mean by that, Naylee?
Yeah, I if that was my situation, I wouldn't know how to pick that up. Those questions, I'd be wrong.
Yeah.
I kind of equated this process to sparring in Taekwondo. Their statements are kind of like your opponent throwing a kick at you, and there's a whole myriad of counters that I could employ, but if I try to focus on, okay, let's go through my list of counters here, what would be the best one to use, it's too late, I'm on my butt because he kicked me. So if you pick a few things that work best for you and hone your skills there, then you don't even think about it. As soon as you see him twitching, you know, this is what I'm doing, and he is the dude who ends up on his butt because you threw an effective move to counter what he did.
I think that's an excellent point. So maybe I think what he's saying there is, don't get caught up, Naylene, in thinking that you have to have the exact correct answer for everything. Just focus on a few things that you can have in your toolbox, so to speak, to engage the person in the conversation. That's really essentially what we're talking about. But I do agree with what he's saying. In these situations, there is usually a very short window of time that you have to decide what you're going to do, if you're going to act, and if so, what are you going to do? What are you going to say? How are you going to choose to engage the person or the situation or the circumstance? So having a reservoir of tools, for lack of a better term, that you're comfortable using would be a big first step. And that's what he's trying to give us here, is some just simple things to do. Right? Simple things to do. He goes on he says in the guide notes, he says, sometimes the first Colombo question is directed at a specific statement or topic of conversation. So maybe it's about this specific statement about the Bible, you know, being written by men, or maybe it's about the topic of evolution, or the topic of abortion, or whatever the topic is, right? So he says other times the question can be more open-ended to make friendly conversation to draw the person out of it, okay? And as the discussion continues, gently guide the dialogue, if you can, into a more spiritually productive direction without additional questions. Or, excuse me, with additional questions. So, you know, that's the guys. There are guys that I work with who are more than happy to talk to you about football, basketball, baseball, every other thing under the sun, right? But as soon as they think the conversation is even remotely going in the topic of religion or theology, they don't want any part of it, right? So, if you can, I've thought about this a lot. I've thought about ways to, okay, they're talking about this or they're talking about that, this game or that game or whatever. How can I try to at least get them to think about something using that as a conversation starter? I will freely admit to you that I haven't necessarily found a good way to do that. Part of that is, you know, the context of where I'm at and what else is going on, and you know, you have to take all those things into consideration too. Do I have enough time to do this? If I engage, am I going to have enough time to really, you know, do this in a way that's going to be productive? But if you're just going to try to accomplish that, you don't necessarily need 3 hours. You might be able to do that in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 3 minutes, depending on what's happening. Okay? So we're about out of time, and so what I want to do next time is we're going to look at the second lesson, and in the second lesson, he is going to talk about refining Columbo, using Columbo, the second question to establish the burden of proof, and then also deal with what do you do when somebody picks up on what you're doing? How can you skillfully address or deal with that issue as well, okay? So we'll look at this. You're still on your homework. Just be in chapters 2, 3. What did I tell you to read last time?
2, 3, and 4.
Is that what I said? So you should be looking at 3 and 4 then, I'm going to say, throughout the week. All right? So thanks for your attention, and we'll look at that, continue looking at this.